Welcome back to the Back Stretch at Saratoga Race Course. I'm Tom Amello, and this is our final presentation of our summer track series of podcasts. And joining me here on the back stretch is Michael Kipnis. Now, Michael and I have had conversations through this podcast series earlier in the meet, and we've touched a couple of subjects. Last week we talked about the Travers, and we'll start there for a moment, Michael. You know, we talked about the contenders in the field. Code of Honor was impressive.
Yeah, Code of Honor, you know, was one of our horses that we kind of narrowed it down to the major contenders. It was pretty formful.
Yeah.
Code of Honor got a perfect setup, perfect ride by Velasquez, saving ground, angling out. Had a clear run through the stretch, got a decent pace set up, came into the race fresh, and really was clearly best. Peaked at the right time on that day. And Velasquez, if you'd been watching the days leading up to the Travers, he was as hot as anybody.
Really?
And that makes, you know, when jockeys get into a rhythm, it carries over to those big days.
Yeah.
And he rode with a lot of confidence. And McGahee did a great job, and he won his fourth Travers.
Tacitus ran well. I was surprised to see him as close to the lead. Yes, the blinkers and Billy Mott and on the TV, I think it was Maggie Wolfendale, suggested that they were real short blinkers, maybe quarter inch or whatever, just something to keep him focused forward. But I was somewhat surprised to see him as forwardly placed.
He broke sharp. I'm sure not only the blinkers helped, but they probably schooled him at the gate leading up to the race. And look, we both felt the same way. He's not a horse we're picking on top as the favorite. That he can win, but he's shown a tendency to be an underachiever rather than an overachiever, or just winning when you think he's supposed to win.
He may just have a good four-year-old season. It's possible.
Look, he dances every dance, and he runs well. You know, he's going to have to find the perfect setup and perfect spot, and he'll win, and he'll be overbet.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the Bob Baffert ship-in Mucho Gusto, who did exactly what we kind of thought he would. We knew he was going to go to the front. I thought he was going to try and bottle him out, but he really didn't do that.
He ran as well as he could be expected. You know, he ran his eyeballs out in the Haskell. He ran a winning race. I mean, Baffert sent a very sharp and improving horse here, but it's a mile and a quarter.
Yeah.
And that extra eighth of a mile, you know, that's the question for all of them. Simply, he ran his race. He just wasn't good enough at that distance.
Absolutely. All right. Now, to take a different tack to the conversations we've had, Michael, you're not only a handicapper, you're also an owner. And so let's talk a little bit about the whole prospect folks have for ownership and participating in the game on that level, how you over the years have been in and out. You've owned horses, you have not owned horses, you're back, you've got a couple now, and then also we'll talk about the claiming game, which is the way that this game exists, if you will, in the long run.
Well, I mean, I have been chasing, you know, the claiming game for many years. I've won some races. I've learned a lot. I think the number one, well, I think they're all important. I'm not even going to number what's important, you know, number one, two, three. Mm-hmm. This, it's all important. And I've learned the hard way that even though I'm been in the game a long time, there's a learning curve. There's a learning curve in anything.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, you have to find a trainer that is honest, you know, that you can work with, that has your best interests at heart. And, you know, some are good snake oil salesmen, you know, and, you know, fortunately after, you know, I've had some good ones. I've had ones I've been very disappointed in. But I think after, you know, many years doing this, I have someone that I could trust. And that's important.
Yeah. I want to make a point that this conversation, or any time you're talking about trainers or large groups, I mean, you've got a one-third, one-third, one-third. There are those who are almost not good enough. There are those that are good and working to get better. And you got those at the top of the game in any and every industry. When you are ill, you're shopping for a doctor. You know, you're shopping for the best, someone you can trust, and so on. So, what you're saying is something most folks practice with consistency in most other things. It's as important at the track,
right? And you know, and then look at it from the trainer's point of view. It's the only sport where they don't have a contract, so owners could be real. You know, if a trainer doesn't win or, you know, runs third and, you know, there's no protection for the trainer, they could take the shank and lead the horse right away. Mm-hmm. So it's a very strange type of business where, you know, there's no security. And, you know, a trainer could have 20 horses and the next day have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you want a relationship with the trainer. The most important thing is, you don't want to, and it's in any business, you don't want to be undercapitalized. You have to say, okay, I'm setting aside a certain amount of money, whether it's by yourself, with another person or two, or a syndicate. You have to put aside the money that you're going to be claiming with, and then expenses. And, you know, you need to have, you can't just claim and then have $500 left in the bank because your expenses are going to average, you know, $3,000 to $4,000 a month. And so that leads to the next important factor.
But I don't know if people really understand the cost of training and keeping a horse in training. You know, you talk $3,000 to $4,000 a month, and we're not talking about graded stakes horses here. We're just talking about normal run-of-the-mill thoroughbreds.
Well, you know, take, if I'm racing in New York, I'm paying a minimum of $100 a day,
mm-hmm.
times 30 days, the yeah. $3,000. Then you have the vet bills, and they can range.
Yeah.
You know, you're never going to pay a vet bill less than $750, you know, and it could be upwards depending on what trainers, you know, are overusing the vet. Or basically using the vet the right way with training, with hay and oats, and you know, and so I'd say the average is $1,200 mm-hmm. something, $1,300 a month for just the vet bill, and then you have the day rate, which is the $100 a day. So you want to race in jurisdictions where the purses are really
sure.
good, because if why run a horse? You're paying, say, you're paying $70 a day at a small track, and you're going to Belterra or where the purses aren't good. You know, economically, you know, in order to stay afloat, you have to win. In New York, if you run second and even third, it buys you time because the purses are so good. So you want to always try to win.
Let me just ask you this. You came through the Oscar Barrera claiming days, the Gaspar Machera, the Pete Ferriolas of the world, and even earlier, it was the purses were never anything near where they are now, even adjusted for inflation, if you will. A lot of that was also about cashing a bet, wasn't it?
Back oh, well, it certainly was, especially the names you're mentioning.
Yeah, well, but it's much less so today, in my opinion, because of the purses. What's your thoughts on that? It you know, the grand putovers that some people had to do to really make it, it's not really necessary.
No, you know, it's I take this approach, and you've been around me a long time with horses that I've owned. Rarely do we bet our horses, right? And it's the way I look at it, it's double jeopardy. You know, like the worst feeling in the world is losing the race and then losing your bet.
Losing the bet.
You know, yeah. So you want to kill yourself, you know. At least, you know, if I don't bet and I lose, well, the dead ferret comes out,
there
you know.
You go,
so it's you know, I'm superstitious in a way too. You know, I'm happy to win and collect the purse and move on. You know, but the most important thing is it's a business, and you can't get married mm-hmm. or be emotionally involved with the horse. Now, I love horses. I love animals. I'm an animal lover by heart. But I need to spot the horse where I think the horse could win.
Let's talk. Spotting horses means the condition book, does it not?
It does. Yeah. It means, right.
You're not only a horse owner, you're a handicapper. The condition book is important to the handicapper, and it's important to the trainer owner, because it's all about spotting, and the spot is in the book, right?
Yeah, but as a handicapper, I'm not really looking at the book.
Okay.
Because I'm not anticipating, you know, I'm looking, the entries come out.
No, I understand.
So
I'm just talking about the condition book as the conditions. We're handicapping horses who are already entered in a race, and trainers are looking to spot their horses in a spot where they think they have an edge. And you really want your horse to be a snug fit to the conditions, if you can do that.
And I've done that with a race we're running on Monday here,
okay.
where I have valued this horse. I claimed a horse for 25, and he's run three times for me. He almost won off the claim in a starter 10. And those horses in that starter 10 were worth at least 35 in New York or 40. I was hurt by a slow pace the second time in a race, a starter 10, same type of horse, right?
A starter 10 protects the horse, right?
Protects the horse, right? But it's horses that have started for 10,000 yeah. for 2 years.
Right.
So they could have developed into 40 claimers, 50 claimers.
Yeah.
So now I'm saying to myself, okay, I bought the horse for 25. I value him at 25. He's been running against horses that are worth 35, 40, maybe 50 in New York. He's been missing with excuses by a couple lengths, two lengths, dead rail last time, like excuses. I want to win. So where am I going to put him? Well, first, what's his best distance? Because mm-hmm. you have to correlate the situation, the distance, right, with the level. You're trying to marry the two to give the horse the best possibility for success. This horse is a mile and an eighth horse. So I'm not going to go through the condition book and look at races for 7 furlongs or a mile, right? I'm looking for a mile and an eighth or further.
Yep.
Right? So I find the right distance. Now I'm saying, okay, there's a race for 50 and there's a race for 25. So the 50, I may be overmatched. I'm probably going to be overmatched. The purse is higher, right?
Yeah.
But in my mind, I value him at 25. I know I'm probably going to lose him, right? But there's an old saying, and I'll say it over and over again. Best saying in business. Nobody ever went broke showing a profit, okay? So if I run him at 25, the purse is 56. 60% is 32,000. Expenses 3,000, 4,000 plus if someone claims him, so it's 55,000. In the time I've owned this horse for 2.5 months, I will have shown a profit if I can win the race of maybe $30,000. Now, you know, if I lose him, that's where the emotional part of it is.
Right.
it is what it is. This is a game of economics. You can only stay in the game like gambling with what chips you have left in your pocket. No chips, you're out, right? You have to have
You're watching.
You have to have chips, right? So that's my philosophy about owning a horse. A lot of people want to protect their horses. And why should horse... I never want to be 20 to 1. How many times do I start a horse that is...
That's the conversation that we've had on a couple of occasions. And it's in the context of what we were talking about before, the notion of a putover. It's hard for a 20 to 1 shot to win any kind of race. And if you're thinking you're going to win when everything on paper says you're hopelessly overmatched, it's almost ludicrous. You really want to be the favorite.
I want to be the favorite. I mean, I said before I die, I want to put over one horse in my life. And I did that with Lydio at Keeneland in a 6-horse field paying
$60. Yeah, I remember that one.
That was a setup, and I got the job done. And I'm not going to test the gods of racing again. I'm done. They paid me off. They paid me off, and I'm happy. And now I'll never try to do that again because I don't think I can do it again. I'm not that good to do it again. The gods of racing answered my prayer. Mm. Now what's left is to win a race at Saratoga with my guys, with my buddies, with me, you know, so that they're not blowing taps at the end of the race. Sam the Bugler blowing the taps, you know, that there is some. So that's really the claiming game from my perspective. Maybe somebody has another way of looking at it. But I'm looking at it as a business, economics, and I want to be the favorite, or at least in the top 3 or 4 choices. You've seen all the horses I've started in the last few years. They're always that way. Yeah. Rarely are they long shots, because I want them to figure.
Well, it means you found the right spot. The morning line guy knows you're in the right spot, and the crowd knows you're in the right spot. That's all.
Right. And then you just have to hope. You got the jockey gives you the ride. The pace sets up.
Yeah.
You know, there's no such thing as a sure thing.
No.
And so what I'm trying to do is, in the long run, if the horse is spotted right and you've managed the horse well, then you have to just let the cards fall the way they fall. And you hope success will come. That's all you can do.
So let's when you're handicapping, do you have one eye on the card that you're looking at, be it Churchill or Gulfstream or even New York, on the claiming box?
Yeah, I am looking, and you know, I have money in an account here at Saratoga this meet, and it's been the worst claiming meet I've ever seen, and there's been nothing really of interest. And maybe
what are you looking for, and what doesn't interest you at all?
I'm looking for horses that I feel have been mismanaged, maybe at wrong distances, have been forced to run into spots that where the horse is overmatched or is not. Mm-hmm. You know, I would take from trainers that are not winning trainers. I don't take from trainers, you know, from certain trainers that I don't think I can improve on, right? So there's like a pot, so to speak, of names that, you know, I look to take from. And then there's some I just stay away like the plague because I know I don't want any part of it.
Just out of curiosity, you know, we're at the end of the meet, and throughout the meet, they run maiden specials, maiden claimers, and a lot of expensive horses, $600,000, $400,000, $250,000, end up in maiden claiming 40 or maiden claiming 50, not even maiden claiming 75, because they don't run too many of those. Now, these are high-priced horses who drew those prices because of pedigree and confirmation and the like, and after 1 or 2 or 3 starts, they're dropped to the bottom. I used to say that was Rene Araya, Rene Araya's market. He repeatedly would claim some of these high-priced drop-downs, take him back to New York, give him time off, and bring him back for the winter and win some races.
Yeah, but where is he now?
Well,
I mean, I don't know where he is. I mean, I don't know if that's the ingredient for success in the long term.
I don't know,
but like the best example of this now is Chad Brown and Klarovich. You know, like they you see these horses 300, 400, 500,000 running for maidens 50, right? Maiden claiming 50. If they feel they have something for the long term, they ain't in for maiden 50.
No, that's for sure.
They just don't want to be the last person holding the bag, and neither do I.
I get that. I'm just wondering, God, that's an awful lot of money to burn, an awful lot of potential somebody saw that nobody's going to take advantage, or you're not interested in taking advantage of.
You know, there could be a situation where I would, but like, you know, they've paid, because they're basing it on pedigree and confirmation as a yearling,
right,
or maybe as a two-year-old. You know, something could have happened. They didn't develop, right? So they overpaid.
Okay.
So, look, there's something called, in the IRS, called tax deductions or taking losses, right? So, you know, take Klarovich. There's a lot of gains.
Yeah.
Don't you need losses to try to offset? Look at it that way.
I'm not a tax guy, but that's a very interesting point. Yeah.
Look at it that way. So they're saying, okay, we've got all these gains, capital gains. We need losses. Well, this horse isn't going to be a stakes winner. We'll take the $300,000 loss. Look at it that way. Klarovich is a money guy.
Yeah.
The guy's a brilliant financier.
Yeah.
He knows the numbers.
Yeah.
It's numbers. I'm an idiot compared to a guy like that as far as finance goes, but I do understand what the guy's thinking.
That's well said. Yeah. Balance the books.
You got to balance, right? I was cashing. I remember a guy cashing tickets. He had all his winnings, and he'd pay for losing tickets because at the end of the year, he had to show more losses.
Yeah.
He actually won, but he was actually buying tickets at a discount so that he could take those losses. Okay? Do you get it? That's the math.
Those days in New York.
I did it on a pick six. I sold a ticket. He gave me like a $5,000 premium because he needed the ticket.
That's too much. Oh, man. So we're talking about a race that's coming up. We're taping this on Wednesday of closing week, and the race that we're talking about is coming up on Monday Labor Day. Yes,
right.
9 furlongs,
25 claimer,
25 claimer, and it should fill. It should fill.
I hope it does. You know, I mean, I hope it does, or I've wasted money, you know, getting the horse up here. I mean, I'll ship to Belmont, but I've done everything I can. We watched the horse work yesterday.
Yeah.
And, you know, but again, look, I got the horse in the spot for success. I ain't riding the horse. I didn't train the horse up to this race. You know, I'm not going to bet, you know, because, you know, I haven't done the race. I hope that he needs pace. He's going to rally from off the pace. He worked over the track well. But, you know, I don't know.
No, that's right.
We don't know. I mean, I hope he's in a good spot that when I'm handicapping in the race, I could say I'm putting him on top. I'm going to put him where I think he should be.
Of course you will.
And if somebody said, well, you put him third, but he won the race. Well, I felt going into the race he should be third. I mean, I don't know. You know, look, I'm not I'm a handicapper. I don't profess to be better or worse than any. I respect a lot of people. I do my work. I'm only going to win if I win 33% of the time, which this meet, I'm probably winning a little less than that. I'm losing 60-something percent of the time, right?
That's what we are.
I'm selling an opinion, right?
Yeah.
I'm not forcing people to buy my work. I'm putting an opinion, and it's the same way when I run a horse that's in my name. If I like it, it'll go on top. If I hate it, I'll throw it out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I'm trying to be like unemotional about it and do how I see the race.
Let's shift gears. I want you to address two subjects. One, I'm going to call it the conflict between the process of handicapping, looking at a race, and coming up with contenders and anything and everything that people do, and everybody does it differently and uses different tools and applies their intuition as best they can, and constructing tickets and getting to the window and constructing a ticket that represents your opinion and maximizes a way to get money out of the pool on that opinion.
I mean, look, as you've said to me many times, I've never seen a race that there wasn't a bet in. Okay, so that's number one. And number two, there's sometimes I buy tickets by the pound.
Yes.
So, I have a product, the betting window, and I update that after late scratches, which no one does. It's a great product. If I have 10 races, I probably say no suggested wages for this race once every 3 days. So it's a feel. Every race I might give a trifecta if I feel that's the play. I might give an exacta. It's all a feel. I'm betting my own money. I learned that way, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, no one who knows me, I've buried a lot of people. They've carted a lot of body bags out of Wiz Village, right?
Yeah.
So, but I've also had some success. It's instincts.
No, I understand that. I understand that. But I'm talking about the audience and how they approach process, and then most folks fall down on the ticket construction and the consistency that's necessary to find a way to win more often, not necessarily always. Nobody's winning always.
So look,
let's talk about that.
Look, I always say, if you want to learn how to bet, think of it like you're going to college for 4 years. Start with a real low amount, like 50 cent, whatever it is, where it's in your comfort zone. See what wagers fit your personality. Like, it's all about what that individual can stomach. Like, I have a guy who's, but all he does, he manages billions of dollars of Wall Street money. Great money manager, highly educated. He bets win and place only. And I tell him, fine, I want to be your bookmaker, and I'll give you a 5% rebate. And I'll say, why only win and place? And he'll say, because I'm scared to play anything else. And I said, well, if you want to make a score, put yourself in a position, try different things. Don't be stuck in a box, right? That's his comfort zone. I could talk to him blue in the face until he starts doing it.
Yeah.
I think the first thing is don't overbet. And don't, because then you're starting to chase. There's all kind. You got to be prepared. So you got to know what you're betting. You got to, like, I know ahead. I'm working ahead. I have to refresh my memory because I don't even know who's running half.
Yeah, that's right.
But like I kind of have a backbone of the day, a framework of the day. You just can't go to the track and expect to do what I'm trying to tell you to do. When you haven't you're handicapping race one,
right.
Race two, you've got to be prepared, and then you have to have a kind of an idea on the day. Do you have a single? Do you love a horse? And maybe he's a short price, right? Well, do you want to bet him at 6-5? Maybe if he goes off at 8-5, you're getting value. If you think he should be even money 6-5, maybe it's a win bet. But maybe you can make him a pillar, like a single on a pick three or pick four, and you may have some opinions, And so, look, I could spend hours on this subject, but the most important thing is you got to try and dabble. And when I say be prepared, like, if you love Track Facts, or you love The Wizard, or you love Andy Serling's picks, or you love whatever, listen to what they have to say, and maybe there's a horse that they love on the card, you know, that becomes something in your plays. But you can't go to the track and expect to win if you go with a woman, number one. you drink beer or liquor, right? Like, you can't win. Like deposit the money. It's, you know, when you're checking in your security, your suitcase, because you're not winning. You can't bring a woman to the track.
That's, I'm going to save you here. You're talking about, said another way, you must be able to focus.
Right.
So you should not come to the track with distractions.
Exactly. I mean, unless you're there for fun and having fun and you're going with $100 and you just don't care, right? And you're having a good time. Well, that's one way to deal with it. And then buy a Track Facts or buy your sheet that has about the odds board, which I believe there's great, you know, validity to. And enjoy yourself. Put the sheet in the back pocket. Enjoy your friends. Have beer. Get drunk, right? And fun. Take out the sheet with 2 minutes to go and bet. Or take it seriously like you want to win, right? And prepare and learn the game. And there's not a lot of those anymore. That's the game. Those people that learned like we did from our parents or whatever, it doesn't exist. So find a handicapper you trust, study what they're saying, and use that as your guide.
You bring up, you know, the point that I think you and I talk about every 3 to 4 months, and that's, you know, in poker you're looking for the guy around the table you can beat. In racing, there's the pecking order, and the industry needs new people who are going to come to the college and pay some tuition, and the lack of those tuition dollars, if we don't draw those folks to the game, it's the whales eating the whales, and the experienced people eating the experienced people, and the price is getting shorter and shorter.
Yeah, it's the dynamics of the game have changed drastically, and you know, it's a lot tougher. It's a lot tougher.
So, when we're done with Saratoga, you have products for how many tracks after Saratoga? You always do New York.
I always do New York. I do Churchill and Keeneland. They're solid meets. I do Gulfstream. I'll do Santa Anita leading up to the Breeders' Cup. You know, but the days of doing Delaware and you know, those
Finger
small
Lake
tracks, they're non-existent. You know, my products are very labor intensive, as you know, because you've done some, and it's, you know, you tell me, Wiz, I feel like I'm being carted out. Like, I've probably taken 5 years out of your life hanging around with me, you know. So you know, it's hard work, and I'm not going to do small tracks when there's no sales.
Yeah. The Breeders' Cup has totally overtaken what used to be the all Belmont experience, and I don't know if that was the ultimate intention, but that's what's evolved. I miss those Belmont preview days and those days before the Breeders' Cup.
And that's why how many unplayable races do you see in these Grade One races where it's like five horse fields, short prices, very. You know, it's only benefits the owner and the trainer and the jockey, not the better. You know, and what's amazing, this is probably the microcosm, or this capsulizes this game. When the pick four on Arlington Million Day, okay, in the Secretariat, the Beverly D, the Arlington Million, and the Pucker Up. A 50-cent pick four pays $27. Oof. In fields of 10 and more, Chad Brown winning all four. That sums up what the game has become. Competitive races, Europeans, horses from everywhere, $27 for a pick four.
For all that work, when all you really had to go, Chad across the board.
And me doing a sheet, right? I'm not picking that. I just won't pick a $27. I won't do it, right? So, you know, who wants 20? Like, what's interesting about that? I have no beef with Chad Brown. Yeah. God bless him, right? Like, God bless him. God bless Klarovich. God bless these people that are taking down all the money, right? It's not their fault.
Yeah.
But what about all the other trainers? Where's the game? You have a game slanted, right, one-way direction, and only getting worse because money, they're getting all the money to buy the horses. Chad Brown delivers, right? He has horses, multiple horses, and they're races that I ride on my sheet. The first thing I say is Chad Brown holds a royal flush, right? And I'm looking at it. I picked him first, second, third, right, in the race.
Yeah.
And there's three other horses, right? So what you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
It is what it is. Something has to change.
Yeah. Well, what can change? You know, it's really an irony because we're talking here about all independent businessmen. You can't legislate what people can do with the horses, who they're going to select to train. If they spend a lot of money on horses, you know, they want to gravitate to X number of trainers. There has been the talk about limiting stall numbers, right, so that other folks, so that they either have to race elsewhere or other folks can get stalls, but I don't know if they have the courage to do that.
And, I mean, that's not going to stop Chad Brown from, you know, if he can't get, you know, 100 stalls in New York, he'll get a 30 in Monmouth, he'll get wherever, he'll even go to...
Chip.
Yeah, so, like, I don't know, I can only do what I can do, and that's just, you know, do my best job in my little space.
And it's a good job that you do, and it's hard work that you do. You know, this is not a mutual... love fest here, but you know, I've known you for since 1989, right?
30 years.
I met you when you did your first seminar at the old 7-Eleven on Central Ave, and you brought a slideshow, you brought video, and you brought a list of trainers. I mean, the Dr. Alphabet, the Maryland trainer.
Right.
What the hell was his name? Jay, now I can't remember the name now. I'm sorry I brought it up. But who was the guy who shipped his own, he drove his own van up from Maryland all the time? Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have brought that up. But we go back a long way. And, you know, what you said early on, I purchased your products a long time ago, and I tried to understand what I did learn. What I did learn back in the day was that what I called the whiz words. The whiz words that describe what you see on the form. And I did the same thing with Russ Harris. You tried to figure out when the words were indicative of the feeling for the horse. And I think that's something that folks can gain from either if they're reading somebody's picks or just listening to them during a paddock prattle or something like that. The words you choose will indicate how powerfully you feel about the horse you're talking about.
Yeah, and you know, I have a friend, the Matzah Man, right? That he, whenever I walk around, he wants to see my trip book because he wants to see the red. You know, if I have like three stars, like he knows how to handicap me, and people read my stuff. They know how I feel about horses just by what I write, you know, and but Tom, after 30 years, you're the one guy that deserves to win because you've been following me and you've paid for not just one 4-year education, but a couple educations.
That's right.
And you still know nothing like I know nothing either. Like what have we learned in all these years?
It's a great game, and the greatness of the game is in the challenges and the people you meet when you're on your challenge, as you will. And I mean, I know when I see you walk around the backstretch, you know, there's nothing but old friends back there. And the people that I've met in the game over the years are people who I respect and love. And, you know, Saratoga is, for me, a reunion. You know, I live here now, but I've always lived in the Albany area, and I've been here on the track now for 30 years. And so as we come to this week, all the joy and elation before July 11 has coursed through our bodies. And here we are getting ready to wrap up another and go our ways. And that's the cycle. That's a good cycle.
And I have 1 week to resurrect the dead ferret. Because Wiz Village, as you know, started in full bloom.
Yeah.
Right? And now all I went by there today and it's dirt and weeds.
Yeah. Well,
and somebody planted one thing of carnations hoping it'd grow back this week.
There
so I have
go.
1 week to redeem the bankroll.
You
know, the thing about us and about this game, what makes it so great, is you wake up the next day, the sun comes out,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Or it's a new day. And it's a new 9-10 races.
Yep.
And you never know what's going to happen. You know,
that's
I mean,
right.
I even have a jump race I like today that I'm going to bet. And I haven't bet a jump race in 2 years.
All right.
So,
well, that's where we're going to end this one. I want to thank you all for tuning in to our podcast this summer. We hope you enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or criticism, please send them, direct them to CapitalOTB. At their website. Michael, I want to thank you. You've been very helpful as a guest and, as usual, informative, talking about handicapping, ownership, and some of the traditions of the game here as we go forward. So thank you very much. We wish you all a happy ending to this meet and a good Labor Day weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.